Medic one inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic on a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient intubation. IO in place. Stay with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is Eric McCullough, and along with my co-host, Bradley Dean, and he's not here tonight, David Blevins. We are your source for all things EMS. Tonight, we welcome another distinguished guest that's bringing forward a topic that affects services all around the country and around the globe. But before we go into this, I want to kind of talk over to Bradley and see how his weekend has been going so far.
Man, weekend's been going great. Been down in the trenches, literally. So we did some trench rescue this past weekend, working with our rescue guys here. In the local area, great group of people. For those of you that are friends with me on Facebook, you can probably find a lot of the pictures that people tagged out there.
Yeah, I've been seeing some of those tagged. Those are, that looks like fun. That looks like a lot of fun doing that stuff. I never did all that. I stayed in an ambulance and was like, wow, that looks cool, guys. So well,
my mom used to tell me, hey, don't play in the mud puddles and don't play in the mud. But now I'm an adult and I can do that.
And you get paid to do it. Yeah. Now they're paying you to do it. Now you're a professional. You're a professional mud player. I love it. And like I said, David Blevins is actually off today, but he'll be joining us on the next episode. But before we go into this episode and introduce our evening, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. GEMS has been a tremendous partner to the EMS Handoff podcast. While the EMS Handoff serves as your source for all things EMS in the podcast verse, GEMS has been an industry leader in the profession for many years. Go to their website, support their efforts to keep the industry informed, and check out fellow GEMS podcast hosts. Jim also has expanded their podcast platform recently as well, trying to make sure and get all Jim's has added distribution of the EMS Handoff and others through Spotify. So if you want to find this episode, just go to Spotify, look for EMS Today by Jim's for the EMS Handoff on Spotify. Additionally, we would like to introduce you to the EMS Handoff merchandise line with our apparel partner, Pursue Outfitters. That was a lot of P's. Pursue Outfitters. The EMS Handoff podcast has partnered with the Pursue Outfitters to offer a line of comfortable and stylish EMS Handoff gear, t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, hoodies. We all wear this stuff. We love wearing this stuff. Go and grab you one. It's actually really comfortable. I like wearing them. And I paid for it. Bradley paid for it. We like our shirts. They're great. We'd love to see pictures of you in our social media and our EMS Handoff merchandise. Visit pursueoutfitters.com/EMS Handoff to find the color of your choice. So with no further ado, it's time to get started for the topic of this evening. Bradley, why don't you go ahead and introduce our listeners to our next guest?
So our guest tonight is really, man, he's got a wide range of stuff that's out there in the media. Very knowledgeable, great guy. So he's been a nationally certified paramedic since 2005. He was a second individual to successfully complete the Emergency Medical Services Research Fellowship offered by the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians. And after completing that program, he was a research assistant professor with the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In the department, he was the director of Emergency Medical Services Research for the EMS Performance Improvement Center, which developed and maintained comprehensive statewide data for EMS systems in North Carolina, South Carolina, and West Virginia. In addition to serving as a research director, his research focuses on patient care in the pre-hospital environment, EMS occupational health and safety, disaster preparedness, and understanding the EMS workforce. And in 2012, he was elected as a fellow for the American Heart Association, and he currently works as a research scientist for ESO and is a co-author on one of the papers that I'm working on. Tony Fernandez, thank you for joining us. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you for having me. This is an honor to be here. I really appreciate it.
So I'm glad you were able to join us. A couple of weeks ago, we got to spend a little bit of time together talking about a couple of different things and working through some stuff. And we talked a little bit about some research and some things that were going on in North Carolina and across the country with plasma and blood and a couple of other things. So you sent us a couple of great research articles that really point to a couple of things. And, you know, everybody's searching for that magic bullet that we talk about. So what can you tell us about these research articles that have been published over the last few years?
So I think that these are some really interesting things. So when we look back at 2018, which after COVID seems like it was a really long time ago, but it really wasn't. In 2018, there was a paper published in The Lancet that was titled Plasma First Resuscitation to Treat Hemorrhagic Shock During Emergency Ground Transport in an Urban Area. And this was a randomized controlled trial. And this was a secondary analysis of data collected to analyze the utility of plasma. And what they found in this study, they did not find a difference between the two groups. One was treated with plasma and one was treated with standard crystalloids, right? And they didn't show any difference in the two groups. Now, when we go back to this year, there was a paper published just a few months ago in February. This paper was entitled Prehospital Blood Product and Crystalloid Resuscitation in Severely Injured Patients, a Secondary Analysis of Prehospital Air Medical Plasma Trial. And in this study, they found that any blood product resuscitation was associated with lower mortality than crystalloid-only resuscitation. And I think that what's really interesting is you can have two trials that had similar methods. Both were secondary analysis of a randomized trial that came up with some really conflicting results. And one way that I like to kind of make this work in my head, and I think is one thing that we're going to talk about pretty in depth tonight, is that when you get into research, particularly in the pre-hospital environment, one thing that you need to remember is that when they come up with the gold standard, which is a placebo-controlled, double-blinded, randomized trial, right? Those are done in very controlled situations. And Dr. Pepe, very recently, in October of 2020, published a paper. And in his paper, this was on a completely different topic, but one thing that I want to quote from his paper, which I think is so important to remember when we're talking about EMS research, is that they point out that failure to control for important factors in the study design can lead to conflicting results. And this is tremendously important when we talk about EMS, because one system in EMS could have vast differences from another one. Even slight differences in a system can change how you analyze these results or what results you end up seeing at the end of the trial. So I think that when one thing that I'm really interested in diving into tonight is how the difference in the study choreography, so to speak, can lead to different results, and how you really need to be an expert in our field, in EMS, to interpret what these results mean, rather than just relying on what the discussion says in the manuscript that was published.
Yeah, you know what, that brings up a good point, because you're talking about research in EMS, and because our field, and I get it, our field is littered with people who are from technical certificates to, they may have some higher education degrees and stuff, but we're not statisticians. We're not entirely research based. So I can see where there can be some contention, I guess, with some providers who, like, they see an article on GEMS or wherever they see it, they read the headline, and they read some other part, and they make a conclusion. When they're going through that, what other information would you have them sort of like kind of look into and like if you had it, like we have to do a salient features of an EKG to diagnose an EKG.
Sure.
What are some salient features of a study that a medic could look at to get an idea of what that study is?
Absolutely. And that's so important. So I want to start off with just the basics, right? So in most studies, when they talk about any statistical analysis, most times they will report a point estimate and a p-value. And your p-value is, it's interpreted the same no matter what the study is. So when I say to you, or Bradley, if I ask you, tell me what a hypotensive patient, tell me what their systolic blood pressure might be for a hypotensive patient, you would respond back.
Well, less than 90, which is what most people are probably right. going to tell you
about
for systolic.
About less than 90, right? Yeah, about less than 90. That's your kind of borderline, right? But that's a line where you're going to pay attention to it, right? It's the same thing when you're dealing with research and statistics. When we're talking about a p-value, and a p-value is essentially the number that's going to tell you if a result is statistically significant or not. When you're looking at that, you can analyze that the same way that you would about 90 for a hypotensive patient, right? And that number would be 0.05. And if the number is less than 0.05, that is a statistically significant result. If the number is greater than 0.05, that is not a statistically significant result. But when it's 0.05 or around there, you need your judgment, just like you would as a clinician if you have a patient who is 90 systolic. That patient may always be 90 systolic. Right, but you have to use your judgment to make some claims about if that is important, clinically significant, and relevant or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So p values that's nice to know. It's a good refresher for some of us who have had stents, but it's also a really good thing to know for those who've kind of like gone through it and they see the p number and they have no idea what that correlates to. So that's a good salient feature. Are there any other ones that you would have them look at?
Absolutely. So if you want to be, I like to talk about being an educated consumer of research, particularly in EMS, because you don't necessarily need to be a statistician or an epidemiologist. You don't need to be a scientist, but you have, if you work in EMS, you are a clinician and you have background to be a subject matter expert in these. And in this topic. And one of the things that you'll see a lot, particularly when we have an outcome that is something like live or die, where there's two choices, admitted or discharged, live or die, you'll get an odds ratio, because and odds ratios are ubiquitous. You will see them, and interpreting them is really important. And the way to interpret them is, again, just like you would a patient who might be hypotensive. The number, though, is not 90 and it's not 0.05. The number there is 1. And you will say that 1 is no difference. There's no difference in either group if the number is 1. If you're less than 1, the group that is less than 1 the group that is less than 1 is less likely to experience the outcome. So if we're talking about mortality, the group that has an odds ratio less than 1 is less likely to die. If we're talking about, again, mortality, and the group has an odds ratio that's greater than 1, then that group would be more likely to die. So 1 is, and if the odds ratio is 1, then there's no difference. Now, the way to, what's also important when you're interpreting odds ratios is to understand what a confidence interval is. And a confidence interval is to give you context around the odds ratio that you just saw, right? So in odds ratio, we talked about it being 1. We talked about it being less than or greater than 1. Whatever that number is, right, what we have to understand is that's the number that we found for this one study, right? And if we're talking about, but we want to understand that if we did this study 100 times, what do we think, where do we think our numbers would be? And that's essentially what a confidence interval will tell you, is if you repeated this study multiple times, we will, if you're, let's say your odds ratio was one and you had, or let's say your odds ratio was 1.2 and you had a confidence interval from 0.8 to 0.20, what you, or 0.125, right? You're, what we're saying here is that if you did this study 100 times, 95% of the time, we would think that you will get a result between the those two confidence intervals. Now, if we take that a step further, when your confidence interval crosses one, because we already said that one is the difference between it being different or not different, right? If your confidence interval, if one is in between the two bounds of your confidence interval, that's not a statistically significant result. And that just those three things that we talked about, confidence intervals, odds ratios, and p-values, you can pretty much interpret any research that you will see in medicine. There, you might see something like a risk ratio or a hazard ratio, but you're going to interpret those all in a very similar way.
So, and sorry, Bradley, did you have something?
No, I was just looking and going to say that a couple of excellent points there. And I hope that people listen to that whole thing about confidence intervals and the p-value, because a lot of paramedics don't read it, the research, and they see something, they go, well, that must be good. But understanding the p-value is really important.
And I especially think in this world when we have free online access to medical education, I'm sure you've seen the growing movement. So if you got this, let's just say you got this medic and they're scrolling through Facebook or they're scrolling through anything online, they're just trying to find something like for Narcan or whatever. Are there particular like red flags of studies that you see where you're like, whoa, that's, you need to reevaluate that. Maybe it's a source, maybe it's numbers, maybe it's how it was done that you've seen that may give you some pause?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up. So let's start with the basics. If you want to take a study seriously, the study needs to be peer reviewed. And what that means is that the study has been, it's been submitted to a scientific journal, and experts in the field have reviewed that study to make sure that the science is appropriate, that the conclusion is appropriately based on the results, and that your conclusion and your discussion are not overstepping what you found. That's that. I mean, there's a lot more that goes into peer review, but in the basic sense, a peer review is people who study this, scientists, other scientists saying, yes, this meets just the basic standard of science. If a study is not peer reviewed, take everything with a grain of salt. It could still be true, and the results could still be valid. But if it's not peer reviewed, it's really, really hard to tell. So one, you want to make sure the study is peer reviewed. Two, you want to see where is it published. There's something called an impact factor that you can look at for medical journals. And essentially what an impact factor is it tells you how impactful that study was, how many times was it cited, how many times was it used in other research, what science was based off of this study. And journals have different levels of impact factors. So if you're looking at a medical journal with an impact factor that's way above two compared to an impact factor that's much lower, you can understand how relevant those findings are. That's not to say that if a journal has a low impact factor, that the results of that study are any less relevant. What it does say though is that the results of this study have been through a more rigorous analysis of the validation of that study than it's just being posted online.
Yeah, and I think that's where And that's why I wanted you to approach that, because in this, I guess, this consumerism that we have, and I do like that, if anybody takes nothing else away from that, I hope they get that educated, the educated consumer of research.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a statistician, but there are some things where, like, I try to think of like a medic who has a new medic with them, or a new EMT, and they may bring up a study and they can go over that stuff and be like, hey, this is the stuff you ought to look at. And also maybe consider embedding this into paramedic programs as part of initial education, so that we look a little bit more like our peers in allied health, nursing, physician, and all that. I'd like to take this a step further if we can. So there was two studies we were going to discuss tonight. The plasma first study with that you already talked about, and also the pre-hospital blood product and crystalloid solution in the severely injured patient, a secondary analysis of the pre-hospital air medical plasma trial. I said all that because somebody might be listening to this podcast and writing that stuff down. You'll need to slow this podcast down by 0.5 for that. But that's so we have two different studies, similar content matter. One says one thing, one says the other. What is your thoughts on that?
So I think whenever you have conflicting results, one, you need to go back to the methods, and getting through the methods of a study is probably the least interesting part of the study for folks who are not scientists. And it's because you're talking about how you got from point A to point B. In other words, you're talking about A squared plus B squared, but you're not going to give the C squared yet, right? And understanding those methods, though, they really change the way that you can interpret those results. So these were two studies that were both done. They were done in similar time frames, and they were both secondary analysis of data that was already collected for another purpose. And I think that what you want to take away from these two studies are that, and again, we talked about the PEPI study, is that the differences in whether an intervention can work or not work in a system cannot necessarily be teased out by a clinical trial, because there are other variables that cannot necessarily be accounted for in every trial. There may be something that works great in one system and systems that look like that system, but the other systems may have a slight difference that is or is not accounted for, and that could really change what you see. And I think that's what we see in these two trials, is that they were both very well done. And I would say that if you spoke to the authors, and when you read the manuscripts, you get this in their discussion, both trials seem to be pointing to the fact that having blood products in the pre-hospital environment is a benefit to patient outcome. But the way that the studies were designed and the way that the analysis was performed, they found conflicting results. And one study, the study that was from 2018, that found that they did not, that it was not as impactful, I think if you read that discussion, you'll see that they make a point to say how important it is that it's a secondary analysis of data that was already collected. And in the study that similarly, in the study that did show an important difference, the authors of that study, not only did they say why it's an important difference and why it being a secondary analysis is important, but they also tried to put it into context with other literature. And I think that when you take into account the totality of the research, I think it's pretty clear that if we can logistically get blood products on ambulances, it will benefit our patients.
No, that's, yeah. And see, that's good to know, because I'm glad you brought these two studies up, because I think that's a big concern too for EMS professionals, as we're looking at the there are two different studies that say two different things. We're just throw our hands up and we're like, well, this one says no, but this one says yes. And they're both science. So which one am I supposed to go with? As they're examining some methodologies, because I'm guilty of this too. I read the abstract. I read the conclusion. I pretend like I know what I'm talking about when I'm in the middle of that, because I never paid attention like I was supposed to in statistics class in grad school. And so I'm like, oh yeah, there's some nice charts. That looks pretty. There's a number. I recognize those things. So I'm guilty of doing that. Are there specific methodologies that you can say, yeah, this is a good methodology and this is a bad methodology, or this is a poor, this is not bad, but maybe like more poor than this specific methodology for collecting data?
So I would say that it's not as black and white as this is a good methodology and this is a bad one. I would say that it's you have to take, so read the method section. I can't emphasize that enough. Read the method section so you can understand what the system did, what kind of patients did the system have? What was their trauma center, their trauma centers like, their trauma system? How many patients did they deliver to multiple catchment areas? I think that you can make more determinations on, and this is the first paragraph of any methods section. You'll understand kind of what's going on in that system. And you could from there determine if that system is similar to yours. And are those results similar to yours, something that you might see working in your area? If you review the methods and it's a system that is vastly different from yours, then again, take it with a grain of salt. And all the best research, and I can't emphasize this enough, all the best research leads to further research. So if you are in reading a study and you say, there's no way this would work in my system, prove it. Right? And call me, call Bradley. We will certainly tell you how to get that done. But add to the literature, because you can, and we need folks out there in these systems to do that.
Okay, well, and there we go. I like that. Throwing the gauntlet down. I like that stuff because, I mean, no, it gives a good challenge to some of the EMS providers out there, especially like I look towards the senior EMS folk who are still on the ambulances and stuff and say, oh, that would never work or whatever. If they wanted to get started, what are some basic tools or basic things that they could access to help them get started in the first place? I know they can email you and Bradley and get started, but is there anything they can do right now that can get them started?
So there are a lot of resources if you want to get started. The first thing that you need to do is just come up with, it sounds so simple, but come up with a question. Write down that question and read it the next day. And if you can do that, and that's a question that you think you can answer, you've gone miles ahead of other folks who are not that inclined. Just write the question down, and then we can talk about how we may be able to answer it. There's always a literature search, which is really important. If you can search Google, which everybody can, then you can find medical literature. It's, you don't go to Google, you would go to PubMed. And it's a government run site. And if you want any medical literature that was peer reviewed, you will get it on this site. And you search it very similar to how you would Google. There's filters, there's keywords, it's very similar. And you can get published literature from the turn of the century. So after you've written down your question, then go ahead and search PubMed and see if anyone's already tried to answer it. And if whether they did or they didn't is not as important as it may seem. If folks have already attempted to answer that question, that does not necessarily mean that their answer is relevant to your system.
if folks have not attempted to answer that question, then you have an open book that you get to fill out. Methods and stuff like that, those are things where you're going to want to talk to. You're going to want to talk to an expert, someone who's done it before. But getting off the ground, it just takes a little bit of determination.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And I like the idea of, like, you can look at a study and you're like, but it could be a similar. I would argue that if you're in a service and you're like, yes, I can find a study and it's as a similar place, if you're just wanting to try it out anyways, because you, of course, would know more about your own service. There's got to be differences. There's too many permutations of EMS services out there. And you may come up with vastly different numbers. I found this when we were when I was doing my own education research at the college, and found all sorts of conflicting findings from what I was supposed to. So, I think it's really important to be active in that and steps from doing our own research. So let me see. Bradley, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, before we move to the next one, I'm just going to kind of wrap these two up, because they're trauma and really a lot of good stuff, even though they're a little bit conflicting with some stuff. When you critically read research and you find multiple articles and it looks like there's a little bit of conflicting stuff there, keep in mind that when I look at these, I see a couple of things here. Our patients bleed one of five places. They bleed in the head, the chest, the abdomen, the pelvis, or the floor of your ambulance, and you can stop one of those. The other patients need blood, and they need damage control from a trauma physician, trauma surgeon. So patients would benefit in the pre-hospital setting from blood. Both of these articles say that. One says longer transport times, it may be beneficial. Shorter transport times, it may not be beneficial. One of the big things I will put out there is the financial burden that it does put on an agency is huge. People ask me all the time, when are we going to start carrying blood and doing this? I said, well, have you got enough O negative people? Because remember, we need to be carrying O negative blood because we can't type and cross match. Do we have enough O negative people that are willing to donate as often as necessary to keep us in supply, because there's not enough O negative blood? So is it good for EMS? Yes. Longer transport times? If you're within an hour and 15 minutes to a trauma center, probably not worth your time.
And that's exactly, you're highlighting exactly what a lot of these authors, especially the Pepe article, was saying, that it's really hard in EMS to account for all the variables that come with pre-hospital emergency care. And systems are different, and some systems have resources and some don't. Some are very far from trauma centers. Some are pretty darn close. And the determination of if blood is useful in the pre-hospital environment is not a yes, no question. It's a maybe.
So maybe we should go back to looking at bovine-derived hemoglobin. So, all right. That kind of wraps up these two. You know, a lot of stuff out there. I'm not going to say that it's not beneficial. Just keep in mind, there's a lot of other variables that go behind that for those of you that are listed. The other thing we're always looking for the magic bullet in is cardiac arrest. There was another article that we looked at. Basically, the rationale and the strategies for development of an optimal bundle of management for cardiac arrest. You know, lots of people have lots of ideas. The AHA does a lot of stuff looking at a lot of research and putting that together in the guidelines. But this article came out, was it last year? Was a pretty good article. Yeah. So I'll let you introduce this one and we'll talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, so this was really interesting. So what I like about this is there were some mixed methods that the authors employed in this article. So the idea was to find out for those systems who are just doing great,
in taking care of patients who suffer from out of hospital cardiac arrest. They are head and shoulders above the rest. What are they doing that's different, right? And what the authors did was they did two things. One, they looked at the results that these systems had published on their own. Then they took those same results and compared them to a controlled or a cohort, basically the CARES system. So everyone, they compared them to everyone who reported to CARES. Then they found out, yes, these systems are still, even when they're not comparing just to themselves, even when we compare them to another group, these systems are still doing really well with this patient population. That's great. So then they wanted to figure out, well, what makes them do better? And I think one thing that's really insightful about this paper is that they found out that it's not one thing. You can't say that there's one thing that makes a system better at taking care of patients who suffer from cardiac arrest. There's bundles that you need to account for. And there are system factors that you need to account for in there that have to do with education and the like. So this paper, after they had already come and analyzed these 10 systems that were head and shoulders above everyone else when they compared them to themselves, head and shoulders above everyone else when they compared them to the rest of the CARES database, they held some focus groups and they determined what do these systems do that might make them different from others. And they found that there were some bundles that they could rely on. There were some bundles there were some core things that everybody did. And then there were some things that are relatively new to our field that some folks did, but it still seemed to help. And I think that kind of reading something like this, where this is science, right? This is where you kind of understand that things are not always black and white. You need to be a subject matter expert. You need to want to understand these things to really be able to interpret them. This paper, I think, really kind of challenges you to do that.
Yeah, because as I'm looking and I saw this paper, I could see a training officer or somebody out there who works in the community who wants to use this study, maybe present it to a medical director or even to local government to be like, we need to increase AED training and AED purchases or whatever it is. And they have to be able to justify, because there's real money attached to these studies. And I don't think that people see the track sometimes. Because, I mean, in this study, people who are reading along can see it's like expedited dispatcher procedures, CPR quality monitoring. To me, I'm like, that means somebody's sitting behind a screen reading these spreadsheets. Yeah. Mechanical cardiopulmonary resuscitation, that's a device that's thousands of dollars. So what advice or tips would you give these folks who are going to be going maybe to present to try to get some of this stuff implemented?
So one of the things that I thought was really interesting was they actually did a cost analysis. This paper went all over the board in the way they did this analysis. When I talk about mixed methods, we talked about the statistical analysis they did. We talked about the qualitative study that they did to find out what these systems are doing. They also did a cost analysis. And that's towards the end of the paper. It was a secondary objective, which, again, secondary objectives, the data were not specifically collected for this purpose. So you have to read those results with a grain of salt. But in their secondary analysis, the cost benefit, I believe, and I'll pull it up, but I believe that they said that it would be about a 10% increase in cost per system, which, again, is not nothing, right? But if the long and short of this article is that if you can employ these bundles of care and this system management, it's affordable and it's very beneficial to your patients. Now, truth be told, I am not responsible for an EMS budget. So I would leave that again up to the experts to read this and understand the difference between the systems that are studied in this paper and the difference between that and your system to see if the cost is as low as the authors suggest.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair point because what I would caution people to do is not run out, read an article and say they found something statistically significant. They've learned some stuff, they present it and they get shot down and they feel bad or like, oh, well, I'm never going to read this stuff again because these people don't understand, not realizing, well, there's a lot of other contentions at board too that may, keep somebody from wanting to implement these, especially right away. I would imagine a medical director would want to see more than just one article. They probably want to see a lot more studies and a lot more ways to confirm more than just one thing.
Eric, it's like you put the ball on a tee for me and I got to hit it out of the park now. This is when we talk about an educated consumer, this is exactly what I mean. There is a big difference between statistically significant and clinically significant or practically relevant, right? And just because something crosses that 0.05 threshold that we talked about for a p-value, that does not necessarily mean that is an important result, because it's math. And the fact is that if you have a large enough data set, you're going to find a statistically significant difference between a systolic blood pressure of 128 and a systolic blood pressure of 124. Now, I don't think anyone on this call or listening is going to believe that is in and of itself is a clinically significant or practically relevant difference. You cannot rely alone on the numbers. You have to rely on your clinical expertise. You got to rely on what's in here to really put these studies into context.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. See, that's what I'm talking about. This is kind of like, I feel like we're just hitting like the veneer of statistics, and hopefully this is going to help people be like, oh, I need to know more about this, more than just so they can speak educated, to their colleagues and to medical directors. And speaking of the way that we interpret and all the methodologies and stuff, can you just go briefly into the differences between studies that are conducted in EMS and studies that are conducted in like hospital systems in clinical environments where the stuff is a little bit more fixed and rigid and you can control for more things?
Yeah. So first of all, it is one of the things that is paramount in most clinical trials is that you have a subject that provided you with informed consent, right? So the subject understands the risks and benefits of being part of the trial, and they have consented to be part of it anyway. That is exceedingly hard to do in a pre-hospital emergency environment because you are taking care of a patient which is, for all intents and purposes, the worst day of their life. So I don't care what information you provide them, to say that they fully comprehended that information and were in a state to really consent to that trial, that's hard. That would be hard to believe in and of itself. So in order to do emergency medicine, we had to come up with exceptions to informed consent. And this is relatively new. So when a patient is altered or when a patient is unconscious, they can be enrolled in a trial until such time that either they or their family member can provide informed consent. That makes studying things in the pre-hospital environment, just that alone makes studying things in the pre-hospital environment difficult. And then you put on top of it that we're intubating behind the toilet, and the things that make running in the field difficult. Studying in EMS, studying things in EMS is hard. It's hard. It takes work and it takes dedication. Not that it can't be done. The amount of research done by EMS providers over the last 10 years has increased exponentially, and it has to continue. But my point here, my long-winded way of getting to this point, is that we have the folks, the paramedics, the EMTs, the folks who are in the field, we have to be involved in this research because we understand the field. There are plenty of very, very, very smart folks out there who are emergency physicians, who are epidemiologists, who are interns, who are residents, and who can do this research. But if you haven't been in the field, you're not going to have the same background to understand if this really matters or not. So it's really important that we get involved in the research that impacts our field.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's the thing. Like, I keep going back to the fact that we're still a young profession, but we can only make that excuse for so long. I mean, we're not so young that we don't have people who are already retired from here. I've been doing this since 02, so I'm 36 years old at this point. So I feel like I've had my dues in this. I think this career field is expanding, and we definitely need more people to do research. There are some considerations. I would say, what is your thoughts about partnering up with like universities or with other, have you heard of that? Like EMSHC is partnering with like a local university or a local college or something like that to help conduct study.
I wish that every EMS agency would find a local university or a community college to partner with for these types of studies. They're the instructors, the professors at these universities and community colleges, they are dying for data. They will happily help you with your research and help you publish in some really good and statistically rigorous ways. It getting there and making those connections is hard, but look at your university's college or section of public health. Look at the emergency department. Send an email to the chair. They will answer you if you say that you're interested in participating in EMS research. You just don't know where to get off the ground. And if that doesn't work, my email will be up somehow here. Email me and we will figure out how to get you on the path that you can contribute to the literature.
That's awesome. Cause I always thought it was funny. I would read an article that says something that scientists don't want you to know. And I'm like, I don't know of any scientist that doesn't want you. They can't shut up. You get them going on something, they won't shut up about it. You're like, scientists don't want you to know how to control your blood pressure. That's not true. Scientists want you to know.
No, if a scientist publishes a study, they certainly want more people to read it than their mom. And oftentimes it's just your mom and, you know, maybe your wife if you're good that day, right? So there's nothing that scientists don't want you to know. Besides those aliens that come down, I mean, we won't talk about them. But other than that, scientists want you to know everything.
Yeah, exactly. And what I like about this, though, is I feel like this has made it a lot more approachable, you know, making research a lot more accessible. We do have Google. And, you know, for the longest time, people were like, oh, don't Google that stuff. Now it's like, no, yeah, actually, you should Google that stuff. If your physician is, your scientists are, everybody else is Googling this stuff. Now, I'm with you about the whole, don't just use the top two search, you know, things that could pop up.
Google Scholar works. We talked about PubMed earlier. There are ways and there are valid sites that you can go to without kind of going down a rabbit hole into the nether regions of weirdness, right? But you can, if you go to PubMed, I can't recommend that enough. Google Scholar will get you there. Just type in what you're interested in and put emergency medical services behind whatever you typed in, and you'll find studies from the turn of the 19th century. It's amazing the things you'll be able to read.
No, that's great. That's good to know. I'm glad we waited till the very end to say that, because that forces everybody to have to listen to the entire podcast to get to the actual websites they should go to do the research. So we're nearing towards the end of this podcast. I'm going to give you a moment if you want to give us like your final parting thoughts to all the professionals and listeners out there.
So, yeah, I just want to say it's not as intimidating as it seems. Just pick up an article and read it. And most of the time, you're going to understand 8 out of 10 things that's in that article. And when you read the next one, it'll be 9 out of 10. I don't understand everything in every article. That's not your goal. What your goal is to basically understand where the science is and figure out how you can impact it next. And we can all do that. It just takes a little bit of will.
Awesome. And Bradley, I'm going to get your last takeaway points.
One of the things I would say is, if you're going to spend time looking at Facebook, looking at Instagram, spend some time reading the research behind what we do. And, you know, that's the only way to become, you know, informed. I spend every shift looking at and doing a few things. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll do whatever, but I'm going to sit back and read. If I see something by Tom Heidi or Peter Kudnick or Paul Pepe or Wang or some of those guys, I'm going to grab it if I haven't read that article, because they put out a lot of good things. More if you see Tony Fernandez on there, read it.
Push that one to the side.
Yeah. No, those are wise words. I would encourage I learned a lot through this podcast. There are some things I didn't know about statistics. It's not intimidating. It's not encumbering. In fact, just get into it. Start reading this stuff. Make it a once a month thing, just like you do CEUs. In fact, you can get CEUs for literature reviews in certain states. And I know the registry, I believe they also honor some of those credits as well. Well, this has been, I think it's been an awesome episode. We could probably keep going on and on, but our listeners would not want to hear that. So we might have to have you on for another spin for statistics, because David missed out on it. He's our certified statistic nerd. And so
to be here, and I'd happily do it again.
That would be awesome. So on behalf of my co-host, David Blevins, Bradley Dean, this is Eric. Take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS handoffs.